that are beyond their control, but they feel positive pressure when they are held to their best work. K.R. Sridhar, CEO of Bloom Energy, innovator of green power generators globally, and a renowned scientist himself, has mastered this distinction in his company. He said, "If you want your organization to take risks, you have to separate the experiment from the outcome. I have zero tolerance if someone does not run the experiment, but I don't hold them accountable for the outcome of the experiment. I only hold them accountable to execute." This is one of Bloom Energy's secrets for innovating across complex, integrated technologies. KR understands the distinction between pressure and stress. He cites the famous image of William Tell shooting an apple off his son's head. In this scenario, William Tell feels pressure. His son feels stress. KR keeps the pressure on his team to act, but doesn't create stress by holding them accountable for outcomes beyond their control. 3. Generate rapid learning cycles. In studying multipliers, I have often wondered, how smart do you have to be a multiplier? The answer from Bill Campbell, chairman and former CEO of Intuit, was perfect. You have to be smart enough to learn. Perhaps most important, liberators give people permission to make mistakes and the obligation to learn from them. Admit and share mistakes. When Lutz Ziop took over as general manager of the education business at Microsoft in 2003, it was falling short of its goals for revenue and reach. Lutz needed to make progress fast and could have easily created a stressful environment around him, but he also needed the organization to be creative and take risks if they were to catch up in the market. It was a classic management dilemma. If you take the obvious path, the climate will become tense and your people may become risk-averse. However, if you lessen the pressure by softening the goals, then your organization becomes complacent. Lutz did neither. Instead, he created an environment that was equal parts pressure and learning. Lutz never backed down from the natural pressure for the business to perform, but he made it safe for people to take risks and make mistakes. He did this by how he responded to both his mistakes and the mistakes of others. Lutz was shameless in speaking about his own mistakes. He loves to tell stories, and his favorites are about his mistakes. Instead of hiding his own mistakes or diffusing them onto his staff, he confesses them. When he launched an unsuccessful product, he talked about it openly and what he learned from it. One member of his management team said, "He brings an intellectual curiosity for why things didn't work out. By taking his mistakes public, he made it safe for others to take risks and fail." Insist on learning from mistakes. Lutz creates room for other people to make mistakes. When Chris Peary, the general manager for sales and marketing working for Lutz, was newly promoted to lead sales for Microsoft Learning, he tried a risky promotion. Unfortunately, it didn't work. But instead of rationalizing the mistake, he went to Lutz and admitted the misstep, diagnosed it, and then tried something different. Chris said, "With Lutz, you get to make mistakes, but you are expected to learn fast. With Lutz, it's okay to fail. You just can't make the same mistake twice." Lutz loves feedback. He isn't just open to it, he insists on it. A direct report of his recalled a time he had to give Lutz some tough love feedback. Lutz was involved in a critical project and was particularly excited about the possibilities for the business. As such, he had been dominating the discussion and had taken over. Lutz's direct report scheduled a one-on-one. He sat down in Lutz's office and delivered the feedback. "Lutz, you are sucking the oxygen out of the room. No one else has any room to breathe. You need to back off." How do you think Lutz responded? How would you have responded if one of your people suggested you were a domineering oxygen hog? Lutz's curiosity was triggered, and his response was simple. He asked, "What does it look like? Who did it impact? How do I avoid doing it again?" After taking the time to understand his mistake, he asked his direct report, "Will you tell me if I do this again?" His final comment to his direct report was, "I wish you would have told me sooner." He really meant it. Lutz achieved the climate he wanted even amidst a stressful external environment by generating rapid learning cycles. As Chris Peary said, "Lutz creates an environment where good things happen." Even in times of immense external pressure, Lutz created a climate that drew out people's best thinking and work. he maintained a creative intensity. Tyrants and liberators both expect mistakes. Tyrants stand ready to pounce on the people who make them. Liberators stand ready to learn as much from the mistake as possible. The highest quality of thinking cannot emerge without learning. Learning can't happen without mistakes. Liberators get the best thinking from people by creating a rapid cycle between thinking, learning, and making and recovering from mistakes. They move rapidly through this cycle in order to generate the best ideas and create an agile organization. As K.R. Sridhar explained, "We iterate fast so we can bring cycle time down. The key to this rapid iteration is creating an environment where people can bring up risks and deal with mistakes sooner." A.G. Lafley, former CEO at Procter & Gamble, said, "You want your people to fail early, fast, and cheap, and then learn from it." Diminishers don't generate these cycles. They might request, if not demand, people's best thinking, but they fail to establish the environment where ideas are easily expressed and developed to full maturity and efficacy. The diminisher's approach to environment. Diminishers haven't developed this smooth duality of comfort and pressure. Instead, they jerk the organization around as they swing between two modes. One, militant insistence on their ideas, and two, passive indifference to the ideas and work of others. Timothy Wilson is an award-winning Hollywood property master. He and his team set the scene and create context for a movie, and he has worked on some of the biggest and most successful films. He's a creative genius, but he comes at a high cost. Why? Because so few people are willing to work with him twice. One of his staff said, "I'd take any job before working with him." Signing up to work with Timothy means working in fear and stress with little enjoyment. Those who do work for him say, "You don't want to come back to work the next day." From the moment Timothy steps onto the set, the mood changes. People brace for his criticism. As Jeremy sees Timothy walk over to one of the props that he had been working on for the last 2 days, Jeremy wonders which of the usual insults it will be, or will he perhaps deliver a rare compliment? Timothy inspects the prop and delivers his signature critique loudly into the whole group, "This looks like a prop for a B-movie." And then there are the random things that set him off. If the prop cart isn't organized correctly, he goes crazy. One day he got so tense that he argued with the director of photography and threw his walkie-talkie at him. The set went from tense to tenser as people prepared to duck and cover. Some leaders create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. Timothy created a tense environment by dominating the space, creating anxiety, and judging others in a way that had a stifling effect on people's thinking and output. Dominate the space. Tyrants are like a gas that expands and consumes all the available space. They dominate meetings and hog all the airtime. They leave little room for anyone else and often suffocate other people's intelligence in the process. They do this by voicing strong opinions, overexpressing their ideas, and trying to maintain control. Garth Yamamoto, chief marketing officer at a consumer products company, uses up almost every cubic inch of space in the room. He jumps in and interrupts people's presentations, he expresses very strong and extreme opinions, and either spends his time micromanaging or is noticeably absent. People warn newcomers in his division, "The art of being successful around here is figuring out Garth." One member of his group said, "I think I am atrophying here. I'm probably giving him about 50%. That person has since left the organization and is thriving in another company. Create anxiety. The hallmark of a tyrant is their temperamental and unpredictable behavior. People don't know what will set them off, but it is almost certain that the mood will change when they are around. It is as if tyrants impose an anxiety tax wherever they go. A percentage of people's mental energy is consumed trying to avoid upsetting the tyrant. Just think of the wasted productivity on the set with Timothy Wilson. Instead of using their full energy making A-movie props, Timothy's team worries about the next thing that Timothy is going to say or do, or, for that matter, throw. Judge others. Tyrants centralize their power and play judge, jury, and executioner. In sharp contrast to the rapid learning cycles of the liberator, tyrants create cycles of criticism, judgment, and retreat. Like the presenters scurrying to adjust their presentations for Jenna Healey, the telecommunications sales leader who resembled Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada, people retreat to a safe position where their ideas won't be criticized or exposed. The Japanese have a saying for this, derukuri wa utararu, which translated means, the stake that sticks out gets hammered down. When leaders play the role of the tyrant, they suppress people's thinking and capability. People restrain themselves and work cautiously, only bringing up safe ideas that the leader is likely to agree with. This is why diminishers are costly to organizations. Under the influence of a diminisher, the organization pays full price for a resource, but only receives about 50% of its value. From liberation to resource leverage. Why do liberators get the full value from their resources? Multipliers know that people are intelligent and will figure it out. Because they engage people's natural intelligence, people offer them back their full brain power. Because people have a foundation of safety and comfort, they are free to offer their boldest ideas, not just the safe ideas that will keep them out of the wrath of a tyrant. The environment of learning has enabled them to take risks and quickly and inexpensively recover from them. There is an assumption that underlies the practices of a liberator. It is that people's best thinking must be given, not taken. A manager may be able to insist on certain levels of productivity and output, but someone's full effort, including their truly discretionary effort, must be given voluntarily. This changes the leader's role profoundly. Instead of demanding the best work directly, they create an environment where it not only can be offered, but where it is deeply needed. Because the environment naturally requires it, a person freely bestows their best thinking and work. Multipliers not only get full brain power from their team, they grow capability rapidly. Our research shows that they don't just get twice more, they get twice the capability with an extra 5 to 10% growth bonus. Diminishers, on the other hand, believe that pressure increases performance. They demand people's best thinking, but they don't get it. They fail to establish the environment where ideas are easily expressed and develop to full maturity and efficacy. An unsafe environment yields only the safest ideas. The following information reflects why tyrants leave capability on the table while liberators extract full intelligence and capability from the people around them. Tyrants, what they do. Create a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capabilities. Tyrants, what they get. People who hold back but appear to be engaged on the surface. Safe ideas the leader already agrees with. People who work cautiously, avoid taking risks, and find excuses for any mistakes they make. Liberators, what they do. Create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. Liberators, what they get. People who offer their best thinking and really engage their full brain power. The best and boldest ideas. People who give their full effort and will go out on a limb and learn quickly from any mistakes. The promise of a multiplier is twice the capacity. Let's now look at a few of the starting points for how someone becomes a liberator to their organization. Becoming a liberator. Remember that the path of least resistance is often the path of the diminisher. As Michael said, it's not like it isn't tempting to be tyrannical when you can. Becoming a liberator requires long-term commitment. Here are a few starting points. The starting block. 1. Play your chips. If you want to create more room for others to contribute, and especially if you are prone to dominating a discussion, you might consider a good game of poker chips. Matthew is a smart, articulate leader. However, he often found himself frustrated and out ahead of his organization, struggling to bring a cross-functional team along with him and his ideas. He was also struggling to be heard. He had great ideas, but he was simply talking too much and taking up too much space in team meetings. I was working with him to prepare a critical leadership forum for his division. He was eagerly awaiting the opportunities to share his views about the strategy for advancing the business to the next level. Instead of encouraging him, I gave him a challenge. I gave him 5 poker chips, each worth a number of seconds of talk time. One was worth 120 seconds, the next 3 worth 90 seconds, and one was worth just 30. I suggested he limit his contribution in the meeting to 5 comments, represented by each of the chips. He could spend them whenever he wished, but he only had 5. After the initial shock and bemusement, wondering how he could possibly convey all his ideas in 5 comments, he accepted the challenge. I watched as he carefully restrained himself, filtering his thoughts for only the most essential and looking for the right moment to insert his ideas. He played his poker chips deftly and achieved 2 important outcomes. 1, he created abundant space for others. Instead of it being Matthew's strategy session, it became a forum for a diverse group to voice ideas and co-create the strategy. And 2, Matthew increased his own credibility and presence as a leader. By exercising some leadership restraint, everyone was heard more, including Matthew as the leader. Try giving yourself a budget of poker chips for a meeting. Maybe it is 5, maybe it is just 1 or 2. Use them wisely and leave the rest of the space for others to contribute. 2. Label your opinions. As you know, formal organizations can create a strong deference to the opinions and thinking of the leader. One executive described his first week as the newly appointed president of a large company. People came at him from all directions to ask him their pent-up questions. He was new and wanted to be helpful, so he would offer a casual opinion. To his amazement, weeks later he found that his opinions had become a set of disjointed policies. As he unraveled the mess, he learned to carefully label the difference between a random musing, an opinion, and a policy decision. Try the practice used by Michael Chang in his Shift to Liberator. Divide your views into soft opinions and hard opinions. Soft opinions, where you have a perspective to offer and ideas for someone else to consider. Hard opinions, where you have a clear and potentially emphatic point of view. By doing so, you can create space for others to comfortably disagree with your soft opinion thinking and establish their own views. Reserve the right to have hard opinions for when it really matters. 3. Make your mistakes known. There is no easier way to invite experimentation and learning than to share stories about your own mistakes. As a leader, your acknowledgement of your personal mistakes will give others permission to experience failure and go on to learn and recover with dignity and increased capability. Great parents do this with their children. They understand that their children are liberated when they know their parents are human and make mistakes just as they do. They especially appreciate knowing that their parents learned from their blunders and recovered. When we help people see a path to recovery, we spawn a learning cycle. As you share your mistakes, try these 2 approaches. 1. Get personal. Let people know mistakes you have made and what you have learned from them. Let them know how you have incorporated this learning into your decisions and current leadership practices. As a manager of a consulting group, you might share with your team the time you led a project that failed and how you dealt with the livid customer. You can focus on what the experience taught you and how it shaped your current approach to project management. 2. Go public. Instead of talking about mistakes behind closed doors or just one-on-one, bring them out in the open where the person making a mistake can clear the air and where everyone can learn. Try making it part of your management ritual. As a corporate manager, I would often take this practice to the extreme. A regular feature in my staff meetings was screw-up of the week. If any member of my management team, including myself, had an embarrassing blunder, this was the time to go public, have a good laugh, and move on. This simple gesture sent a message to the team. Mistakes are an essential part of progress. Each of the above is a simple starting point, but if done consistently over time, these practices can allow a leader to become a powerful force for liberating the intelligence from within an organization. A liberating force. On January 1, 1831, William Lloyd Garrison, an anti-slavery activist, began a paper called The Liberator, of which he published 1,820 issues over 35 years. In The Liberator, Garrison spoke out eloquently and passionately against slavery and for the rights of America's black inhabitants. He wrote in the first edition, "I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard." Garrison's fervor captures the essence of multipliers. They aren't necessarily social activists like Garrison, but they do activate intelligence. They aren't tyrants, but they can be a bit despotic in their liberation. Multipliers liberate people from the intimidation of hierarchical organizations and the domination of tyrannical leaders. They see intelligence around them, and they release it into the organization so it can be freely utilized at its highest point of contribution. They create an environment where ideas can be heard and where intelligence can be given, grown, and stretched through challenge. Chapter 3 Summary: The Multiplier Formula. The Tyrant versus the Liberator. Tyrants create a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capability. As a result, people hold back, bring up safe ideas that the leader agrees with, and work cautiously. Liberators create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. As a result, people offer their best and boldest thinking and give their best effort. The three practices of the liberator. 1. Create space. Release others by restraining yourself. Shift the ratio of listening to talking. Operate consistently. Level the playing field. 2. Demand best work. Defend the standard. Distinguish best work from outcomes. 3. Generate rapid learning cycles. Admit and share mistakes. Insist on learning from mistakes. Becoming a liberator. 1. Play your chips. 2. Label your opinions. 3. Make your mistakes known. Unexpected findings. 1. The path of least resistance is often the path of tyranny. Because many organizations are skewed, a leader can be above average in an organization and still operate as a tyrant. 2. Liberators maintain a duality of giving people permission to think while also creating an obligation for them to do their best work. 3. Multipliers are intense. Leaders who can discern and create the difference between a tense and an intense climate can access significantly more brain power from their organizations.
Chapter 4. The Challenger. The number one difference between a Nobel Prize winner and others is not IQ or work ethic, but that they ask bigger questions. Peter Drucker.
In 2005, Shai Agassi sat in a large auditorium in Davos, Switzerland, at the World Economic Forum. He was there as one of 200 young global leaders, an elite group of up-and-coming world leaders, all under 40 years of age. At the time, he was a top executive and board member at SAP and was assumed to be next in line for CEO. As he sat in the forum, he was asked a simple question. What could you do to make the world a better place? The question and the challenge stuck with him. He left SAP in 2007 and founded Better Place in Palo Alto, California. Shai started with a simple question. How do you run a country without oil? But initially, the answers were far from simple. He first posed the questions and tested the ideas with his colleagues at Young Global Leaders and with a white paper to the WEF. He looked at alternative forms of transportation and worked on the question for 6 months in small groups. After several iterations, he could see the opportunity. After a year, he knew pursuing this opportunity was the right thing to do. He began building the team that would make it happen. An idea for a better place. To build his team, he simply explained the opportunity as he saw it. This was nothing short of a chance to make the world a better place, which inspired the name for the company. Better Place. He then explained the possibility. Known for his sharp intellect and ability to see around corners, Shai began to assemble the pieces of the story. He explained the logic supporting electricity as the most viable energy source for cars and took others through the same logic. Barak Hershkovitz, CTO for Better Place, said, "After a 5-minute conversation about the opportunity, I decided to leave my job and join him." A challenge. Not only did Chai explain the opportunity he saw, but he began to lay out the challenge. To make electric cars a viable option, someone would need to build the infrastructure for recharging or switching batteries. Someone would need to be the AT&T and build the network across a vast geography. After months of analysis, the team realized that battery charging could not be the most viable solution. They would have to build an infrastructure for rapid battery switching at stations much like gas stations. Shai issued the challenge to the team and began asking the difficult questions. How can we change a battery in 5 minutes? And how can we make it user-friendly? And location-independent? And car-independent? And cheap so it can be scalable? He turned the problem over to the team and gave them 2 months. The team then broke the challenge down into pieces and constructed a solution. Within 3 months, they had a working prototype, not for a battery switch in 5 minutes, but rather a solution to switch a battery in 1.5 minutes. It was beyond his outrageous expectations. A possibility. Shai is an expert in making the impossible possible, says one senior member of his team. He breaks down the challenge in a way that makes you believe it can happen. Barak recounts a pivotal moment for Better Place. I was preparing for a critical meeting with one of the car makers. I knew they were skeptical about the solution we had developed, so I had developed a plan B, which was a compromise that might be easier for them to adopt. Right before the critical meeting, I told Shai that I had created, reluctantly, a plan B. Shai asked me, "Do you believe in what you are doing?" He paused. "Is it the right solution?" He sensed my hesitation and asked, "Is there a better solution?" I told him that there wasn't a better solution, but that plan B represented a compromise that would not work as well. Shai told me, "Believe in what you do and stick with the truth. I'll back you up." I stood up at the meeting with the car maker and gave the speech for the original solution, not the plan B compromise. It must have been in the way I said it and in my conviction, but all of a sudden, the impossible became possible. The whole room was now in support for the original solution. Shai is a master at defining opportunities that dare people to stretch beyond what they know how to do. This is one reason why Shai was listed in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People list, published in a May 2009 issue. His team describes what it is like to work with such a challenger. He'll outstretch all your capabilities to make it happen. He is highly demanding, but you feel great. You know you are signing up for something that will challenge you on a daily basis for many years to come. You will challenge yourself and all your capabilities. Exhilarating, exhausting, challenging, gratifying. He's a big source of energy. He is a source of power and a tailwind for what we do. Shai gets more out of people than they knew they had to give, and they love it. It appears the man who seeks to charge the world's electric cars has found a way to charge the people in his own organization. Consider another company founder. The Expert. Richard Palmer founded SMT Systems in the mid-1990s in the United Kingdom to build systems and tools for business process re-engineering. Started as Richard's brainchild, the company's intellectual foundation was built from his expertise as a business process analyst and in expert systems. The process re-engineering work appealed to Richard's sense of methodology and superior strategy, both developed through years of playing chess as a youth. Not only was Richard one of England's youngest chess champions, holding a master rating, but it was common knowledge throughout the company that he was a chess champion. It was typically the first thing people said about Richard, chess champion and Oxford University graduate. He was clearly a genius and the chief genius in the company. While he gave the title of CEO to someone else, everyone knew Richard, who remained the chairman of the board, was still the one who called the shots on budget, pricing, products, compensation, and company strategy. An army of pawns. The energy changes in a room when Richard enters. It is as if the headmaster has entered the school assembly. People begin to shrink. People react the way they might when the calculus teacher gives a surprise oral quiz, getting smaller, hoping he or she won't call on them and find them lacking. Despite the fact that everyone fears the attention will turn to them, the attention often just stays with Richard, who works to make sure he is seen as the expert and smartest person in the room. In one executive management meeting, Richard put the company general counsel in the hot seat with a pop quiz about a technical distinction on a very specific legal code regarding corporate governance. Richard had become concerned that his general counsel didn't fully understand the nuances of this particular code that had to be reported to the city, so he began launching questions. One by one, the general counsel answered them until the questions became more precise and delved into nuances and obscure scenarios. The general counsel looked puzzled, but answered the questions to the best of his knowledge. But this didn't satisfy Richard. Richard left work just in time to stop by a W.H. Smith bookshop before it closed. He didn't buy just any governance book. He bought the 600-page manual on the most recently announced corporate governance codes. And he didn't just look up the answer to the question he asked. He stayed up through the night reading the entire book. The following day, he called a meeting of the executive team. The topic for this emergency management meeting was, of course, this particular code. Richard professed his newfound knowledge and quite publicly let everyone know everything the general counsel got wrong. Bad Bishop. Richard is a master of the gotcha question. Richard only asks questions that he knows the answer to. He asks questions to test other people's knowledge and to make sure other people understand his point of view. One of his vice presidents said, "I can't think of a single time that he has asked a question when he didn't know the answer." He is also a master of the stall question, which he uses when he doesn't have the answer himself. He is known for asking frivolous questions during teleconferences to stall the conversation while he Googles the answers to get ahead in the conversation. One such stall was during a meeting with an account team that was planning their sales proposal for a deal with British Telecom. The sales team was reviewing the proposed contract. Richard, who appeared to not yet know exactly how the contract should be worded, jumped in with, "How many of you have read British Telecom's field operations manual?" The document was 500 pages long and not your typical reading for a sales representative. Wondering if this was a trick question, the team tentatively confessed that they hadn't read it. Richard replied with, "How can you even understand this contract and sell to a BT if you haven't read the field operations manual?" The sales process came to a complete standstill while the entire account team and Richard, the founder and chairman of the board, read the manual. One team member said, "He wasn't the kind of leader who would say, 'I have an idea. Why don't we look in the manual to better understand the business and the terms of the contract?' Instead, he made us look ridiculous for not doing it." Fool's mate. It is no surprise that really smart, talented people don't stay long in this organization. Some are asked to leave when the founder finds out they aren't as smart as he'd like. Others quit and stay, giving up on the idea of making a meaningful contribution. The sharpest people leave because they see the wasted time and talent and know the organization can't grow beyond its founder. Although the company has been able to grow sales under Richard's leadership, most believe that the organization is inherently limited. They remark, "We'll never become a serious company." One of these two founders operated as a challenger. The other founder operated as a know-it-all. This chapter is about the difference. The know-it-all versus the challenger. The approach of these two founders captures the essential difference between how know-it-alls and challengers provide direction and pursue opportunities for their organization. Diminishers operate as know-it-alls, assuming that their job is to know the most and to tell their organization what to do. The organization often revolves around what they know, with people wasting cycles trying to deduce what the boss thinks and how to, at least, look like they are executing accordingly. In the end, diminishers place an artificial limit on what the organizations can accomplish. Because they are overly focused on what they know, they limit what their organization can achieve to what they themselves know how to do. In setting direction for their organizations, multipliers have a fundamentally different approach. Instead of knowing the answer, they play the role of the challenger. They use their smarts to find the right opportunities for their organizations and challenge and stretch their organizations to get there. They aren't limited by what they themselves know. They push their teams beyond their own knowledge and that of the organization. As a result, they create organizations that deeply understand a challenge and have the focus and energy to confront it. The mind of a multiplier. What are the assumptions that lie at the heart of these different approaches? Consider our two founders. What caused Chai to challenge his organization in a way that allowed others to do their very best thinking and best work? And why did other people's intelligence and capabilities stagnate around Richard? We know that both founders are highly intelligent, with a clear vision for their organizations and a passion for their work. But if we examine their approach to setting direction, we can distinguish two different logics at work. Deeply embedded in Richard's logic is the assumption, I need to have all the answers. He sees this as the essence of his job as the leader, and if he doesn't know the answers, he needs to either find them himself or appear to know the answers. What does he do when he doesn't have the answer? He stalls until he can find it. He buys a book on corporate governance. He reads the operations manual. He Googles the answer. He assumes his role is to know and to be the expert. It is an assumption that may have become entrenched in the years he studied expert systems. If a leader holds the assumption that it is a leader's role to provide the answers, and if the employees resign themselves to this mode of business, a downward know-it-all spiral naturally follows. First, the leader provides all the answers. Second, subordinates wait for the directives they've come to expect. Third, the subordinates act on the leader's answers. Finally, the leader concludes, "They would never have figured this out without me." He or she sees evidence to support this belief and concludes, "It is obvious. I need to tell others what to do." Chai's leadership at Better Place follows a different logic. He uses his intellect and energy on two things. First, asking the big questions, and second, showing that a solution is possible. He understands the challenge at a deep enough level to believe a solution is possible. His assumption seems to be that people get smarter by being challenged. As people embrace the challenge, both their insights and the belief grows. Soon, the belief becomes infectious, and the unsolvable problems become solvable. Antiquated arguments give way to new thinking, and what once appeared to be roadblocks become interesting puzzles, which teams solve one by one. If leaders have to spread their intelligence across asking the questions and finding all the answers, they will tend to ask questions they already know the answers to. Once a leader accepts that he or she doesn't have to have all the answers, he or she is free to ask much bigger, more provocative, and, frankly, more interesting questions. They can pursue things they don't know how to do. Let's look at another challenger in action. The Challenger. By 1995, the Oracle Corporation was headquartered in the affluent waterfront neighborhood of Redwood Shores on the San Francisco Peninsula in California. Oracle had begun retooling its products for the Internet, but the business strategy was still unclear. The challenge of figuring it out would fall to Ray Lane, Oracle's president, who had joined Oracle 2 years earlier and had grown the U.S. business from $571 million to $1.2 billion. Ray's revolution. Ray decided to gather the top 250 leaders of the company from across the globe in a series of forums to educate them on the corporate strategy and to align the leadership team behind this strategy. Ray and the other senior executives, including CEO Larry Ellison and CFO Jeff Henley, prepared their strategy presentations and gathered the first group of 30 executives. They gave their presentations and held discussions, but as the week went on, the group became more and more confused. One VP spoke for the group when he said, "We aren't clear on the strategy. We just saw a lot of PowerPoint slides." Ray and his team went back to the drawing board and did a major overhaul of their presentations. They invited another group of 30 executives. This time, the feedback was different. It was an all-out revolt. One of the executives took a risk and said, "Stop getting people together until there is a clear strategy." The team was not buying what Ray and the rest of the team were selling. Independence Day. The senior executive team quickly regrouped at Ray's house on their first available day, the 4th of July. They realized the global business had become more complex and diverse than they originally thought, and that they couldn't build this strategy alone at corporate. They decided to take a fundamentally different approach. Ray and the executive team started out trying to tell others all the answers. they switched to sharing the fundamental questions, trends, and assumptions that were shaping their views. When they came back together with the next forum of leaders, Ray and the other executives shared what they saw happening in the business and where they saw the world going. Ray seeded the opportunities that these trends would present for Oracle and presented a framework for a strategy, four key transformations needed in the business. And then, with this broad stroke of his brush, he stopped telling and started asking, "Are these the transformations needed in the business? And which of our assumptions about the future might be wrong?" Ray gave the group a challenge to fill in the blanks. The team would have 2 days to examine each of the four transformations, identify milestones, and pinpoint the implications for the business, and then pass their thinking on to the next group of leaders, who would go further. The group did exactly that, advancing the thinking of the executive team and then handing off their work to the next group of executives. The group reveled in their collective success and left the forum knowing that they had begun something big. The process continued until all SVPs and VPs had been involved. Each group challenged the work that had been done before them. They took their task seriously, turning the strategy upside down and sideways as they looked for holes, logic flaws, and vulnerabilities. In the end, they emerged with both a validation and a refinement of the collective thinking. The momentum was building. The convention. Ray and the other executives culminated this process by convening the entire leadership team of the company. The executive team unveiled the strategic intent of the organization and the transformations needed in the business. The reaction of the global leadership team was overwhelming enthusiasm and optimism, knowing they would be making business history. The strategy was fresh and compelling, yet it was familiar to them because they had co-created it and could see their fingerprints on it. When the meeting was divided into regional breakouts, the scene was far from typical. Instead of a discussion about why this won't work in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, EMEA, the conversation in the EMEA breakout room was almost boisterous, with questions like, "What is the first step?" and "Where can we start implementing this in Germany?" The scene in the Japanese breakout room said it all. They discussed the strategy and its implications for Japan, and then, with quiet fervor, they began to organize as if they were going to battle. What was unveiled in the meeting and the breakout sessions was a manifestation and statement of the collective will of the organization. Under Ray Lane and Larry Ellison's leadership, the organization forged ahead to execute this strategic intent, propelling Oracle into the lead position in the late 1990s for enterprise computing in the Internet world. From 1996 to 2000, Oracle grew from $4.2 billion to $10.1 billion, more than doubling revenues. Ray Lane began with an honest attempt to sell a strategy to the organization, but he emerged a more powerful leader as he first seeded the opportunity and then laid down the stretch challenge for the organization. He didn't set the direction, he ensured the direction was set. He operated as a challenger. The three practices of the challenger. How does the challenger engage the full brain power of the organization? Among the multipliers we studied in our research, we found three common practices. Multipliers: 1. Seed the opportunity. 2. Lay down a challenge. And 3. Generate belief. We'll examine each in turn. 1. Seed the opportunity. Multipliers understand that people grow through challenge. They understand that intelligence grows by being stretched and tested. So, even if the leader has a clear vision of the direction, he or she doesn't just give it to people. Multipliers don't just give answers. They provide just enough information to provoke thinking and to help people discover and see the opportunity for themselves. They begin a process of discovery. We'll outline a few of the ways that multipliers seed opportunity and begin the discovery process. Show the need. One of the best ways to seed an opportunity is to allow someone else to discover it for him or herself. When people can see the need for themselves, they develop a deep understanding of the issues, and quite often, all the leader needs to do is get out of their way and let them solve the problem. The Benyon Center on the University of Utah campus was established to encourage students to engage in community service projects and activism while in college. Irene Fisher, the center's director for 14 years, was hopeful that the students would sign up for some of the city's toughest problems. Instead of making a speech or just selling her vision of service to the poorest members of the community, Irene invited students to take a leadership position and organize other students to work with the community. She took them downtown into the inner city community so they could see the needs for themselves. They walked the streets and observed the plight of the homeless. They visited shelters and talked with single mothers struggling to get by. Because they saw the needs for themselves, they became passionate and curious about how to create change and learned rapidly in the process. As their involvement level grew, these student leaders assumed more and more challenging roles. She noted, "University students are pretty smart. Once they see something, they start asking questions. Our students asked a lot of questions and then went to work." Irene seized the opportunity and allowed the students to take the challenge. Irene added, "I don't see myself as a challenger per se. I think of creating the opportunity for people to see the challenge so they can respond to it." The Benyon Center is still thriving today, built on the assumption that you don't get the most out of people if you just tell them what to do. You get full effort if you help people discover opportunity and then challenge themselves. Challenge the assumptions. Multipliers ask the questions that challenge the fundamental assumptions in an organization and disrupt the prevailing logic. Renowned management guru and strategy professor C.K. Prahalad is known for asking the questions that challenge the fundamental assumptions of an organization. He understands that strategy is about understanding and questioning assumptions. When working with management teams and leading corporations, C.K. has a penchant for asking the unsettling questions that rattle their assumptions and enable them to see market opportunities and threats in a different light. In working with the Philips Corporation, a multinational manufacturing company, and after carefully interviewing each member of the executive team to uncover their core assumptions about the business and the tensions in the organization, he could see that they had an assumed invincibility in the market. C.K. formulated a plan. When he arrived at their executive strategy offsite, he began with a fictitious article he'd written that might appear in the New York Times speculating a bankruptcy at Philips. He then launched the following questions. What changes in the current competitive landscape would devastate Philips' revenue stream? What if companies A and B merged? What market changes could lead to a bankruptcy? What is your game plan if it happens? The room became tensely silent. He had shaken their beliefs upon which the current business strategy was based. With the full interest of the executive team, he guided the discussion as they began to explore the answers. Reframe problems. Multipliers understand the power of an opportunity. As Peter Block, consulting guru and author, observed, "The most powerful work is done in response to an opportunity, not in response to a problem." Multipliers analyze problems, but they also reframe them to show the opportunity presented by the challenges. Consider how Alan G. Lafley, when he was CEO of Procter & Gamble, reframed the problems of generating revenue growth from new product R&D as part of his overall revitalization of the company. As Larry Houston and Nabil Sakab explain in their Harvard Business Review article, Connect and Develop, the invent-it-themselves model was no longer allowing P&G to sustain a high level of top-line growth. At $25 billion, the company could still manage to do it, but beyond $50 billion, it was impossible, and P&G lost half of their market cap as their stock fell from $118 to $52 a share. Rather than falling into the trap of doing more of the same, Lafley developed a new strategy of sourcing their innovation from the outside. The shift was from not invented here to proudly invented elsewhere. Rather than thinking of innovation as invention, where the R&D has to be done in your own physical labs, Lafley looked for ways to join forces with people in their supply chain whom they could partner with to innovate more rapidly. For example, Houston and Sakab relate, when the idea emerged to produce Pringles potato chips with pictures and words printed on the crisps themselves, P P&G had to decide whether to create an end-to-end solution from scratch or whether to find an innovative solution somewhere within their partner network. In the past, bringing a new product to market represented a 2-year investment, but with Lafley's new reframe, they could see a smarter path. In the case of the Pringles, they created a technology brief that defined the problems they needed to solve, and they circulated it throughout their global networks of individuals and institutions to discover if anyone in the world had a ready-made solution. It was through their European network that they discovered a small bakery in Bologna, Italy, run by a university professor who also manufactured baking equipment. The professor's innovation allowed P&G to get to market in half the time and at a fraction of the cost of inventing the solutions in-house. The product was an immediate hit. It led the Pringles division to enjoy double-digit growth for the next 2 years. Create a starting point. Multipliers provide a starting point, but not a complete solution. By offering a starting point, they generate more questions than answers. These questions then encourage their team to fully define the opportunity while giving them confidence that they are building on a solid foundation. Ray Lane and Oracle's top executives created the skeleton of a strategic framework and then asked groups of senior leaders to systematically and collaboratively work to complete the whole strategy. When a challenger has successfully seeded an opportunity, other people can see the opportunity for themselves. And because the opportunity has been planted but is not fully grown, others are taken through a process of discovery. This process of exploration and discovery sparks intellectual curiosity and begins to generate energy for the challenge. And because the answers are clearly not formed, people know there is still something for me to do, and they can step in to be involved. 2. Lay down a challenge. Once an opportunity is seeded and intellectual energy is created, multipliers establish the challenge at hand in such a way that it creates a huge stretch for an organization, while diminishers create a huge gap between what they know and what other people know. Multipliers create a vacuum that draws people into the challenge. They establish a compelling challenge that creates tension. People see the tension and the size of the stretch and are intrigued and perhaps even puzzled. Mission Impossible. Matt McCauley took the reins of Gymboree, a $790 million children's retailer headquartered in San Francisco, at the age of 33, after coming through the ranks of planning and inventory management. This made Matt not only the youngest CEO to head Gymboree in its 30-year history, but also the youngest CEO of a company in Wall Street's Russell 2000 Index. McCauley used his youth to keep him open to the ideas of others. "I love to riff and bounce ideas off of people. Regardless of what their function is, Gymboree employees are all talented, bright people," says McCauley. Matt had been a pole vaulter in college. He set one bar at 17 feet 6 inches, which is what he could clear, but he always kept a second bar set at 20 feet, the world record at the time, to remind himself of what was possible. Matt took this same approach at work. Raising the bar. When Matt took over as president, he had the benefit of a recently rejuvenated product line, but the challenge of some sloppy business operations. He saw an opportunity not only to grow sales, but to vastly increase net income per share, which was then at 69 cents per share. Using his deep knowledge of operations and inventory optimization, he estimated the upside opportunity and then went to the board and told them he believed the company could achieve $1 per share. The board members laughed, but Matt remained convinced of the opportunity. As Matt met with his management team, he explained his rationale for the growth opportunity in both sales and earnings per share. He took them through the calculations for sales and expense optimizations that he had been studying for the last 5 years and asked if they could indeed be achieved. He then threw out Mission Impossible, a net income of $1. He asked each member of his management team this question: what would be your Mission Impossible? As the management team caught the enthusiasm of this high bar approach, they began to ask the entire organization to do the same. Soon, every person inside this 9,500 person organization had a Mission Impossible goal, a crazy aspiration. It appeared that being asked to identify their personal Mission Impossible ignited the charge to make it possible. Clearing the bar. A year later, Matt announced to the board, to Wall Street, and to every employee in Gymboree that they had achieved not just the Mission Impossible goal of $1 per share, but $1.19 per share, which represented a 72% improvement over the previous fiscal year. Fueled by this accomplishment, what did Matt do next? He set the bar higher and suggested to the board that they could achieve $2 per share. This time, the board thought it was outrageous, but he turned to his organization for support, sharing his Mission Impossible task and once again asking every person to create their personal Mission Impossible needed to achieve $2 per share. In fiscal year 2007, they delivered $2.15 per share, an 80% improvement. Again, Matt went to the board to suggest $3 per share. 1 year later, he announced $2.67 per share, and 2 years later, in 2008, an incredible $3.21 per share. That is a more than 50% increase in earnings per share year over year, and an almost fivefold increase in 4 years. This young challenger CEO used his deep knowledge of the business to see both an opportunity and a plan for achieving unheard-of levels of business performance. He articulated this opportunity and laid down the challenge for the organization. He then asked each person to join him in attempting the impossible and to analyze how they might achieve it. By setting the bar high, he gave people permission to rethink the business. By asking them to create their personal Mission Impossible, he allowed them to embrace and step into the challenge themselves. And by acknowledging the impossible nature of the mission, he gave people permission to try without fear of failure. How does a multiplier achieve this level of stretch without breaking an organization? How do you create intrigue rather than apprehension? In our research, we found that multipliers achieve this energizing stretch in 3 ways. First, they extend a clear and concrete challenge. Then, they ask the hard questions that need to be answered to achieve the challenge, but, most important, they don't answer them. They let others fill in the blanks. Extend a concrete challenge. Sean Mendy works as a director of an after-school program in East Palo Alto, California, a city that in 1992 had the highest per capita murder rate in the United States, and a city where dropping out of high school is a norm. Sean himself faced many challenges growing up, but went on to attend and graduate from Cornell University. After graduation, Sean decided to spend a year at the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Peninsula. 4 years later, he can't bring himself to leave. Even now, after being accepted into a graduate program at Stanford, you can find him doing his homework at the club beside youth half his age. With a journey like Sean's, he has ample reason to tell the teens he works with what they need to do to succeed. But instead of telling, he challenges. When Sean first met Tajiana Robinson, or Taji, she was a shy and hesitant 12-year-old. When she reluctantly shook his outstretched hand, he stopped her and with a big smile said, "You know, there are 3 things you might want to do when you meet someone. First, look them in the eye. Second, give them a firm hand. Third, shake their hand up and down 3 full times. Taji was appalled, but intrigued. Sean continued to extend small, specific challenges to her. He asked Taji if she would take a newspaper class. She did. Then he encouraged her to write a main article for the school paper, meet regularly with a writing tutor, and learn how to write a great essay. Again, she did. Next, he encouraged her to raise the bar and compete in her school's Scholar of the Year competition. She won. Sean extends these challenges by asking the youth hard questions and then giving them the space to think and respond. As Taji put it, "He taught me to think for myself." This allows youth like Taji to strengthen intellectual muscles and build the confidence they need to tackle the hardest challenges. Early on with Taji, Sean looked her in the eye and asked, "If you could get out of this environment, what would you do?"